Hello and welcome to a Guardian film show with its thumb firmly jammed on the rewind button. We're heading back in time to the Dark Age 1980s, then back again to the black and white 1950s, and finally all the way back to the mid-19th century. The past is not dead, it's right up ahead. Coming up on this week's show, Ralph Fiennes and Felicity Jones play Charles Dickens and his muse in the period romance The Invisible Woman, and Jean Moreau and Maurice Ronet have murder in mind in the re-release of Louis Malle's Nouvelle Vague Noire, Lift to the Scaffold. But we start with one of this year's big Oscar contenders. Dallas Buyers Club is a fact-based tale from the early days of the AIDS crisis. It stars Matthew McConaughey and Jared Leto as the macho cowboy and transgender woman who forge an unlikely alliance as they search for a cure. And here they are, talking to The Guardian's very own Catherine Shored.
Mr. Woodruff, you've tested positive for HIV. Have you ever engaged in homosexual conduct?
Homo. Did you say homo?
You made a mistake.
We estimate you have 30 days left.
Ain't nothing out there can kill Ron Woodruff in 30 days.
I'm not full of a lot of rage, but Ron had an amazing amount of rage, and that, like it or not, is the emotion that gets more stuff done than any other. Wrong or right, it just does.
I've been looking for you, Lone Star.
You treating these people?
How they're treating themselves.
Well, I ain't selling drugs. I'm selling membership. Welcome to the Dallas Buyers Club.
They were incredibly self-sufficient, and they certainly would have appreciated, I think, as much help as they could get. But they're a great example of a group of people that are intent on doing something impossible. And they were intent on surviving. They were intent on breaking the rules. And I think that's a really wonderful thing to be reminded of, the possibility of doing that.
Roger Thompson. This is my patient. You treating these people?
Oh, they're treating themselves.
With what?
Vitamins, peptide T, DDC, anything but that poison you're hawking.
I don't like doctors. I don't want to go to doctors. I don't even have a doctor. I still have never, in 44 years, I've never been able to fill out who's your physician. We grew up, we were like, no, you go to a specialist, had an ear problems, you go to the ear doctor. But I don't like pills. I don't want to take medicine. I don't like prescriptions. But some people need them, and sometimes you do have to take them. I personally, I have my own alternative ways to approach my own health. And usually I've found that it starts with what you're putting in you.
Purely honored to be joined by Henry Barnes and Catherine Shored. Henry, am I right in saying that these two are now the front runners for the Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor Oscar? And if so, are they right to be?
Yeah, I mean, McConaughey might have a bit more competition, but if Jared Leto doesn't win it, then I'll eat my cowboy hat, really. I think it's a stunning performance from him. Great performance from McConaughey, but maybe from him we've come to expect it now that he's going to bring his A-game every single time to every film that he picks. I think the great thing about this film is that it is sentimental, but it's not overly sweet. Ron Woodruff, who McConaughey plays, is a bit of a grizzled bastard, really. Mm. Quite selfish, just out for profit. And for most of the film, he is trying to make a profit out of this horrible situation and to take the gay community for a ride, so to speak, mm. and make money off of them and make money out of the situation. And he's just struggling to survive. There's towards the end, it does kind of flop then into huggy, let's all get along, mm. let's all be friends territory. But before that, I think it's a really sharp, quite biting, satirical drama, really, about a horrible situation.
He's very good in it as well, McConaughey. I thought it was a really good performance. I mean, it's almost the cliche that the kind of shortcut to Oscars is that you pile on the pounds or shed the weight, and you do that kind of physical work, yeah. and then people confuse that with great acting. But it's a terrific performance.
Yeah, I think if you compare it to something like Christian Bale in The Machinist, like it felt like the whole point of that performance was, look how much weight I've lost, and look what a great actor I am because mm. I can lose all this weight. And you're right, with McConaughey, it feels like almost a sideline that he's lost this much weight. You almost feel like he could have done this mm. as a well-built man as well and acted it properly. I think he's just great as these twisted Southern characters who have the potential to be a Southern gentleman as he is, but also have this really vicious and horrible bile in the centre of them, I think.
I thought McConaughey was great. I was less sure about Jared Leto. It seemed like more of a kind of cliched role, the kind of the little broken flamingo who we learn to love.
No, I agree with that. And I think there is, you know, for all its sort of rough edges and it's, you know, all naturally lit and all that sort of stuff, it's slightly, there is at heart quite a cliched drama here. And for me, the performances and indeed the direction were great, but the actual sort of plot was a bit difficult. I mean, you have this character that's played by Jennifer Garner, who's the good, fragrant doctor, and they have to sort of cook up an enemy in terms of the medical establishment, who were, they're not trying to kill these people, they're just trying to do the trial with the ADT, and they're doing it wrong, and they've got the wrong dose. But that's not, they're not actually evil. And so I thought, you know, all
well,
that...
Well, there's a suggestion that the big pharma is kind of leading them by the nose a bit.
A little bit, but it felt to me a bit cooked up, all that, and a bit unnecessary. I was interested anyway in Woodruff and less interested, in fact, in Rayon. Again, it felt slightly, you know, when he's out of drag and when she's out of drag and meeting the father, it's, you know, wanders a bit close to kind of soapy. Yeah, I don't know. It's, for me, better performances than a great film.
Is there something dodgy as well about the very setup of this film? That you've got implicitly all these weak gay people who have AIDS, and what they need is a kind of macho cowboy to kind of get things done.
Wow, I didn't read that into it necessarily.
No,
to
you
be
didn't
honest.
See that at all.
I think the problem is that he's, I mean, the arc as we see it, presumably, is that he's homophobic and learns through getting to know gay people.
Oh, except he doesn't though, really. He doesn't.
No, that's not true.
He doesn't gain salvation through.
He doesn't gain salvation, but he does. You know, you have there's a moment late on where he defends Rayon's honour in front of old friends of his who are homophobic, and that's a real kind of.
It was cute, but then I also think that for him, for the character, that was what he needed to do. He's protecting a business partner, and this is the money he's making. He needs this person to make the money to have the connection to the gay community.
That wasn't business protection. That was a. I've seen the light. I am enlightened, and I will beat you up, you redneck. Yeah. That was what it was. I don't know. It felt a shame that it couldn't have sort of slightly. They didn't do a bit more work on the script, perhaps.
I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's a kind of old school, big, brawny American drama, isn't it? It's got that kind of loose, rangy feel. I'm surprised that it's just the actors that are being honoured, because I thought John Mark Valley did a good job with the direction.
Yeah, I think he did. I think he kind of reminds us a bit here of Soderbergh with Erin Brockovich or something like that. It's taking the essence of the story and giving you that and letting the characters run wild and letting the actors do their thing. And apparently Leto and McConaughey hadn't met before they even got onto the set. And you can get that feeling of them actually building a relationship together, which I think is quite rare in what we've seen recently. It's not contrived, this film. I agree with Catherine that there is some elements of the plot that have been sweetened up and thrown in there to make it a decent movie, but I still think it's actually quite brave to deal with this subject matter.
But I don't know, I mean, some of it did feel contrived to me, like when they're sharing the office and Rayon's put up all pictures of, like, Boy George.
Like, amongst the titty pictures.
A little bit, you know, like repainted, you know.
Chocolate mocha is the colour that she paints the office.
Right. Yeah. I don't know, maybe that was how it was. It just feels a little bit, you know, gay person, you know, 1.0.
Do you have any sympathy for the controversy that Jared Leto finds himself in? He was heckled earlier this week for daring to play a transgender woman when he's not, in fact, a transgender woman. I mean, it's shocking that actors would play people that they're not. But can you see why that's problematic?
No, not really. But I can see that, I mean, it is interesting that you've got this film and you've also got something like Candelabra, where you've got two straight guys playing. Okay, so he's playing the straight man, but still, it's sort of complicated, interesting area, and being immensely applauded for doing so. I think there is something interesting and probably ultimately dodgy going on, but I mean, it's hard to begrudge them.
But presumably, we've got gay actors playing straight in Hollywood all the time, haven't we?
Really?
So they
like
say.
Like you?
Should we cut it right here and I'll just tell you?
Walker, Dorsett, Blunt, Newsom. Jeff Coat. These are patients?
Yes, sir.
They're also the names of players on the Dallas Cowboys.
No. That's a hell of a coincidence, isn't it?
Isn't this a little ridiculous?
Well, he said it.
Matthew McConaughey darting like a whippet towards Oscar night on Dallas Buyers Club. Next up, it's The Invisible Woman, Ralph Fiennes' account of Charles Dickens' ill-starred romance with aspiring actor Nellie Ternan. Andrew Pulver sat down with Fiennes and his co-star Felicity Jones.
You have been generous. Some might say too generous to my family. But I did not realize that I was to be your whore.
Nellie, it was a mistake.
Did you send Catherine to me?
Yes.
She is the mother of your children. How could you be so cruel to her?
And for that, I shall always be grateful. But I do not love her. She comprehends nothing. She sees nothing.
He had a crisis. He fell deeply in love with Ellen Ternan, and it was a complete sort of huge transition in his life. But obviously, his behaviour, it's difficult. He did act with cruelty. And the film is trying not to give any sort of judgment on that, but just to show it, so it's up to the audience.
From your point of view, I mean, would you see the character as a sort of predatory figure? Because it's sort of, I mean, because you can sort of rationalise it and say, well, it comes out of a crisis, but in the end, it's a sort of older man, younger woman.
I don't think predatory is the right word, because I think it was a very genuine love for both of them. I think it was very complicated. Obviously, Dickens is a very wealthy, very powerful man, and Nellie is a teenager and from a very poor background. So there's immediately a power imbalance, which in the film we're very keen to explore. But his behaviour didn't come out of a sort of a predatory nature. I think he felt like a boy. I think it was that he fell in love with this woman in a very powerful way.
I think because he's an older man, I think it appears predatory, because that's often the implication. If it's a much older man pursuing a younger woman, we automatically think, oh, predator. I think Felicity's right. It was a genuine, you know, obsession, infatuation that became a huge love. And I do think that the love speech from Great Expectations, which is extraordinary, which we use in the film, I do think that's rooted in... He read Great Expectations 2 or 3 years into his discovery of Nellie, and I think that was written. I would argue it's written for her.
Catherine, this is Fiennes' second film as director, but it could be more different from Coriolanus, could it?
It couldn't, no. And it's interesting to think why he would want to do this. And it's partly because it's a very good fit for him in terms of an actor, because he's a sort of lavish ham, really. And so it was Dickens, and he plays him like that. He's forever, you know, thesping about. And it's also, it's interesting why he'd want to direct this. And one of the interesting things about it is that it takes Claire Tomlin's book, and Abby Morgan has then sort of massively stacked the deck and massively turned the dial up right to 11 on the possible levels of the affair and whether or not it resulted in various things. So you get it massively soapy, but also she massively stacks the deck in terms of that Dickens was right to have the affair, that it was very valid. Because for a start, Felicity Jones is really hot and they have a really, like, super special connection, you know. And also, poor Ralph finds his wife, Catherine, who's played by Joanna Scanlon very well, is, you know, she's vulgar, she's always got a headache, and then, you know, she's a bit kind of...
She's let herself go.
And you can sort of see that, and then you have one scene where he comes into the bedroom and she's naked. And the whole point of that is just for, so the audience go...
Oh, but look over there, there's Felicity.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, and there's quite a lot of sort of quite heavy-handed stuff, and there's a bit where... Dickens literally builds a wall between him and his wife, which feels a bit... Apparently it did happen, but I'm not sure it happened with both of them standing there whilst the bricky kind of did it. So, but for all that, it is actually also very good for all its sort of coshingness. It's very well played, it's quite moving, and one of the good things about it, sorry, to return to your original question, is that he doesn't play him like a sort of conventional silver fox celeb who's, you know, gets together with this hot groupie. Mm. He's like a sort of, he's slightly repellent as Dickens, you know, when he's forever kind of going, Nelly, Nelly. It's a bit gross, actually, and not that sexy. And that's quite interesting.
Well, he's like the kind of drama teacher at school, isn't he? He's sort of surrounded by all the people that he's putting on a play with, but then he's got slightly inappropriate kind of urges as well.
Okay.
Not to say anything about my drama teacher, who was very good and always appropriate.
It is like that, yeah.
I think you're right. I think the great thing about the character is that there's a frailty to him, and he's susceptible to many, many weaknesses, and we see all of them. And I think someone like Spielberg would have made a film where it was Dickens, and he was the genius of words, and there's no way there could be anything wrong.
He came
with
out of this as a shabby, grubby little man.
He
right?
did, really.
Dickens.
Yeah.
He did.
Well,
I think he did.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, he's too timid to embrace the affair, and that's the sort of the heart of the story, isn't it? That he's, for all of his kind of, you know, socially crusading ways, he's actually a creature of convention who is terrified of his reputation.
And a product of his time as much as he's trying to deconstruct his times as well. I thought Tom Hollander as Wilkie Collins was a little off for me. I didn't really think that the kind of bromance between them worked very well, considering these are supposed to be two of the greatest writers of, you know, British literary history. Mm. It felt kind of slight, really. It felt like a comedy turn from him, which is a shame because I'm a huge fan of Wilkie Collins' books and you'd expect to see more of it. And then also there was a feeling with Felicity Jones that she have to be really, truly stunning to fall for in this way. And I just don't get that with her. She's still a bit of a blank to me,
right.
Particularly in this and in Breathe In as well, her last film. I don't see why these older guys fall over themselves to be in love with her.
I'll give it another 15 years. Sort of feminist thread running through it, though, isn't there? That you're supposed to kind of... I mean, she is the invisible woman, so in a way is Dickens's wife in this, and there's this sense that these are people who are just kind of used and then just pushed aside.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that they were trying to do that, and that the ultimate person who's kind of a bit kind of prudish or whatever is actually Nelly, which is sort of interesting and all that. But I think that's also a plot device because everybody knows that, you know, probably he did have an affair with this lady and they're going to get it on at some point. And you've got a kind of, it's like with Breathe In, it's like an hour or more of like, oh, blimey, a bit of sexual tension, come on, Jesus. And then, you know, after that, it is sort of slightly sag. And I think that the sort of feminist thread is partly to kind of keep the momentum going until, you know, they're done.
You are part of my existence, part of the little good in me, part of the evil.
There is an insanity to his behaviour.
You could find a different life.
A different life? What different life? What life is there for me?
True love hits the rocks on The Invisible Woman. And we end with yet another tale of amour fou with the reissue of Louis Malle's 1958 classic, Lift to the Scaffold. On this occasion, love is taking the elevator. Should he use the stairs?
Nous recherchons Julien Tavernier, accusé d'avoir tué ce matin à 4 heures.
Jean Moreau and Maurice Ronet are the adulterous lovers who devise an imperfect crime in Louis Malle's smoky, sultry Parisian noir. It's a film that doffs its cap to the Hollywood B-movie while anticipating the rise of the French New Wave. Lino Ventura is the hangdog cop who has to make these broken pieces fit together. Henry, when we think of the French New Wave, everyone says Jules Le Jim and Breathless were the kind of the first big two. Mm. Does this lay claim to getting there before them?
I think it does, yeah. I think it was a few years before them, and it was incredibly influential, but in the way that you look back and it was you realise it was that influential. And that can also be its undoing in a way, in that this kind of film has been satirised by so many people. There's a long scene at the start where on the phone and she's saying, je t'aime, and he's saying, je t'aime. And they do this over and over again. And there were moments in this film like that where I just couldn't help but laugh because people like... I don't know, like Griff Rhys-Jones and Mel Smith have done that kind of thing in bad 90s sketch comedy. And you've seen this thing so many times now that it can't help but be funny. That's not to do this film down at all. It's a fantastic movie.
It was radical once.
It was radical once, but yeah, now it does seem very, very traditional in a way.
It's also traditional in that, although it's been cited as the sort of the first of the French New Wave, it's very much indebted to B-movie Hollywood thrillers, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely it is. It is. And it also reminded me a little bit of, it's particularly in the opening scene where he's committing the crime of things like Rafifi, where he's climbing up the rope and getting stuck in the elevator. And a brilliant bit where the secretary's sharpening pencils, and because of the noise of the pencils, you can't hear him commit the criminal act that he's at. So yeah, it's got lovely touches like that. I just think that they're quite familiar now as well.
Catherine, is this a film that you were familiar with before seeing it again?
No, I hadn't actually seen it. And I really love Louis Malle, so I don't know why I hadn't seen it. And I really love La Comme Lucienne, which is his 1974 resistance collaboration drama. And I prefer that still, in fact, to this. Although there is, you know, many...
And Les Amants is great as well.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, yeah. But La Comme, for me. But there's a lot of chiming, you know, the old German guy with the wine I loved, and you know, there's echoes of that in lots of other of Malle's films. Yeah, it didn't quite do it for me. It felt like a first film in that it was sort
of 26 when he made it.
It's incredible. Mm. I mean, that's incredible. Blimey. I mean, this is an amazing film. We shouldn't. But it felt a bit like he was not trying too hard, but you could feel that he was a young man, you know, setting out his aesthetic. Whereas I prefer him when he's just much more simple and like actually.
Yeah, it's a high-concept thriller, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so in that way, it's basically saying, I can do this kind of film.
Yeah, it's a showreel.
Yeah. And it's got the kind of... The other radical thing that may now seem very dated, it's got that Miles Davis jazz score of running across it all, which still sounds great.
It sounds brilliant, yeah, and it fits perfectly. I think that brings out the classy side of the B-movie vibe that you're talking about. Mm. So when you go off with Louis and his girlfriend and they steal the car and they commit their own set of murders... It does feel slightly hokey in terms of the plot, but all the time you have this undercurrent of this sinister jazz trumpet, which just really brings it to life and makes it feel that you're actually in the moment with them.
Je t'aime. Je t'aime. Si je n'entendais pas ta voix, je serais perdu dans un pays de silence. Je t'attends. Je n'attends que toi. Vous n'avez pas vu Monsieur Tavernier ce soir?
Non, madame.
Louis Malle's Lift to the Scaffold. And that's it. Our ride is over. We're getting out of the ground floor back in the 21st century again. My thanks to Henry Barnes and to Catherine Short. And thanks to you for watching. We're back next week.